The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their support. Last week, I left you hanging on the story about marine scientist Mary Mears. The article is called Solving the Ocean. In World War II, victory in the Pacific depended on strategy, bravery, and military might. It also depended on a brilliant marine scientist named Mary Sears. And the Battle of Tarawa and the Gilbert Islands in November of 1943 was one of the major amphibious landings of the war. Now I'm going to jump forward to where we left off and finish. I'll read you the last paragraph before we left off. While Sears spent hours bent over her desk combing through references on undersea organisms, she couldn't help but notice that the hallways were becoming less congested as the men left to join the Navy. She wanted to go, too. Toward the end of 1942, feeling full of patriotism, Sears applied to join the newly established Women's Naval Reserve, the WAVES, all capitals, WAVES. But she failed the medical exam and was rejected because of a prior diagnosis of arthritis. Sears had no current health issues. She exercised regularly, was an excellent candidate. She might have spent the war years stuck at the WHOI, but for the intervention of Lieutenant Roger Revelle, an oceanographer from Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. Revelle traveled to Woods Hole to meet with Woods Hole director Columbus O'Donnell Iceland to convince Iceland to give up one of his precious scientists to serve at the Navy's Hydrographic Office, or Hydro for short. There was only one scientist Iceland was willing to part with, only one he deemed non-essential to the pressing wartime research taking place in the lab, and that was Mary Sears. After Revelle's recruiting visit, Sears reapplied for a commission in the Women's Naval Reserve, but knew she could not be accepted without a medical waiver. Admiral George S. Bryan, officer in charge of Hydro, was also a trustee of WHO and well acquainted with Sears' expertise and work ethic. He knew that she was familiar with ongoing war-related research projects, one of only two locations where women could train to be naval officers. She graduated in April 1943 and started at Hydro, working alone at a desk in the Maritime Security Division, facing an avalanche of requests for data from the Army and the Navy. All too often, charts and sailing directions, if they could be found at all, were hopelessly out of date, in some cases more than 100 years old, even for high-priority invasion targets. Some types of data were never going to be easy to obtain because of ongoing war operations that inhibited the U.S. ability to survey certain areas. Much of this data, such as local tides, currents, or beach conditions for some remote locales, was not easily accessible, especially for those areas in the Pacific where the U.S. had never been to war. Sears was new to her role, but could already see that the Navy needed someone who could quickly assess the information already available on the shelves of libraries and government agencies and determine what still needed to be collected. Sears had just taken her seat as the newest member of the Joint Chiefs Subcommittee on Oceanography in April 1943 when her colleagues asked her to compile all available references on the surface drift of objects in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. That request had come after a high-profile incident involving Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, a renowned World War I fighter ace. Rickenbacker had been on assignment for the War Department when his plane crashed in the Pacific Ocean. The crew had languished for weeks at the mercy of storms, a searing sun, and the constant threat of shark attacks. On day 20, the pilot went looking for help in one of the rafts and was picked up by a naval patrol boat. The lingering question was, why had it taken 3 weeks to rescue the survivors? Even though air traffic control had given the Navy an approximate location of where Rickenbacker had crashed, predicting the drift of objects such as airplane wreckage had proven to be a complicated matter. Sears tackled the assignment with her trademark focus, gathering all the published data she could find and relying on her network of experts at Woods Hole and Scripps for more. But how did she know where to look in the first place? In an age before computers and internet searches, Sears had developed a system of filling out an index card for every article, book, newsletter, or other reference she reviewed. She cross-referenced these by author and subject, filing them alphabetically in black boxes that sat on a shelf behind her desk. In May 1943, Sears submitted The Drift of Objects Under the Combined Action of Wind and Current to the subcommittee members. They endorsed her conclusions without hesitation and forwarded her monograph up the chain of command. Her report laid the foundation for initiatives that would rescue hundreds of pilots and crews lost at sea during the war and put the rest of any lingering skepticism about the capabilities of this female oceanographer. Only weeks later, Sears welcomed Fenner Chase, Jr., a crustacean expert she had met at Harvard, to the oceanographic unit. Chase had been working on cloth rescue maps to help downed pilots find their way to safe shores in the Pacific. Pilots could easily track these waterproof, handkerchief-sized maps in a pocket of their flight jackets. Using his hobbyist painting skills, Chase sketched in the strength and direction of currents on these cloth maps. Sears, fresh from the Drift project, assisted him with the data. The two of them combining their scientific know-how to produce new maps. While it was a major achievement for the new collaborators, their most significant contributions still lay ahead. Sears was already building the oceanographic unit, into a 15-member team of oceanographers, draftsmen, and women. Her core team members did not fit the profile of military oceanographer any more than Sears did. In civilian life, Chase had spent most of his time dissecting and sketching crustaceans in the catacombs of Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. Dora Henry of the University of Washington, a.k.a. the Barnacle Lady, had scoured tidal pools and shoals around Puget Sound and began to assemble an extensive collection of barnacle species. She was so famous that the author John Steinbeck even sent her barnacles he thought would interest her. Meanwhile, Mary Grier, a University of Washington librarian with an expansive knowledge of oceanographic publications, had alleged ties to the Communist Party. However unconventional this team might have been, the Navy didn't have time to be choosy. A series of risky amphibious missions had already been penciled into war plans. After Pearl Harbor, the Japanese had launched a sweeping attack against U.S. territories of Guam, Wake Island, and the Philippines, and against the Dutch East Indies, Malaya, and Hong Kong. But by the summer of 1942, the U.S. had scored strategic victories at battles of the Coral Sea and Midway that promised to give the Allies the upper hand in the Pacific. A further turning point for U.S. forces in the region came when defeated Japanese forces withdrew from Guadalcanal in February 1943. Through a grueling 6-month campaign, the Allies devastated Japanese air, naval, and ground forces. The attacks began with a remarkably successful landing at Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands the previous August, the U.S.'s first amphibious attack in the Pacific. After the battle, the Japanese military had difficulty recovering. While the U.S. wartime industry was ramping up, churning out more and more aircraft, carriers, destroyers, submarines, and aircraft, Japan was meeting the industrial limits and suffering from a lack of raw materials. The victory allowed the Allies to continue on the offensive, intent on driving the Japanese all the way back to Japan. Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, commander of the Pacific Fleet, based his Pacific strategy on the success of amphibious assaults, though he knew none of these victories would come easy. Never before had so many troops been moved across so many thousands of miles of ocean to fight on hostile beaches. The war in the Pacific would eventually cost more than 100,000 American lives, about double the number lost in the Vietnam War. The Pacific saw more maritime battles and more sunken ships in World War II than in all other modern naval campaigns combined. In July 1943, Sears began preparing oceanographic chapters in a series of joint Army-Navy intelligence studies, JANUS they called them, reports to assist in war planning at the strategic level. These reports would describe the geographic, physical, demographic, and socioeconomic characteristics of a proposed military target, every detail that could affect a combat operation by land or sea. Sears had been selected to oversee the oceanography chapters of the reports because the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be using the studies to make pivotal decisions about every phase of the war. This classified research would take priority over everything else the oceanographic unit was doing. It would take enormous effort to amass the data needed to cover all 33 oceanographic topics needed for a single region, much less to analyze it and translate it into lay terms that war planners could comprehend. Sears knew the added workload coupled with tight deadlines would overload her small team. But if the reports met their objectives, the Navy might avoid numerous hazards at sea, saving countless lives. The member of Sears' team fell into their natural roles, the members, that is, fell into their natural roles in preparing the reports. Grier would comb the libraries and agencies around Washington, D.C., and anywhere else that held the best oceanographic data. Chase took the lead on charts and graphics. Henry, who had marked up many a graduate student's thesis at the University of Washington, served as editor, compiling the sections while reviewing them for errors of any kind. Sears attended top-level meetings for briefings on upcoming military targets, helped analyze the stacks of data Grier brought back, and translated the complicated scientific concepts into written text, accessible to lay readers. Oceanographic intelligence was especially crucial for the Pacific campaign. Amphibious operations were an orchestra of moving parts, each essential to the execution of the whole, and each presenting an opportunity for catastrophe. Even with the best planning, the missions faced the inevitable hazards: hostile fire, reefs, swirling currents, rough surf zones, and underwater obstacles. In retrospect, it's painfully clear that the planning of the attack on Tarawa would have substantially benefited by this kind of in-depth JANUS report that Sears and her co-workers were beginning to produce. But by the time the JANUS program was up and running in the summer of 1943, only a few short months remained before the major amphibious assault would begin. Further, the oceanographers were subject to a military intelligence services schedule that didn't prioritize the Pacific campaign, and the Joint Chiefs had the oceanographers analyze Bulgaria as the subject of their first Janus report. Lacking a comprehensive oceanographic analysis, the Marines were forced to rely on spotty oceanographic intelligence at Tarawa. Tidal estimates, mere guesses made on the basis of fallible memory and hearsay, proved ruinously inaccurate and left landing boats stuck on the island's reef. The Marines had no choice but to bail out of their vessels and wade to shore through enemy fire. That December, just a few weeks after the battle, the Senate Naval Affairs Committee asked Lieutenant General Alexander A. Vandergrift, who would become Commandant of the Marine Corps the following month, to answer questions about the heavy casualties at the Battle of Tarawa, up to that point the bloodiest fight the Marine Corps had in history. Following this grilling and the media scrutiny it prompted, and having read an avalanche of letters from grieving mothers of Marines lost in battle, Nimitz re-examined his strategy. Even if the Navy could be relatively confident of victory from here on out, American lives were at stake. He had to figure out something to give amphibious forces a reliable edge through the remainder of the war. For her part, Sears must have thrown up her hands in disgust when news of the debacle at Tarawa reached her. In planning those exhaustive Janus reports, filled with tables, charts, diagrams, and advisories, her team had specifically noted concerns about low water, lower at Nieps than at Springs, the possibility of a prolonged Niep tide like the one that had tripped up the landing boats at Tarawa was right there in black and white. Had the oceanographers been consulted ahead of the landing, no doubt Sears' team would have issued clear warnings about the potential danger. Sears also would have included a detailed description of the coral reefs ringing Tarawa and noted how the combination of an obstructing reef and a dangerously low tide portended disaster. Tarawa shook up the priorities of the team's Janus studies. Just 2 weeks later, urgent planning meetings for targets in the Philippines began. Soon, Sears' team was assigned Janus reports for the Marianas, the Carolines, and the Palus. Sears understood the importance of her mission. While she had no direct say in how the war would be fought, she could gather the very best oceanographic intelligence and get it in the right hands. She felt she owed it to the men who had lost their lives at Tarawa, the ones she never even got a chance to save. Because they were prepared so far in advance, the Janus reports couldn't cover every contingency, so the hydro team often had to answer questions on the fly. According to Sears, these urgent requests, a.k.a. quickies, often followed meetings between U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, where the two were drawing up new war plans. When these quickies started rolling in, Sears would work all night if necessary to attend each knotty query. On one occasion, she recalled, an aide to the Joint Chiefs showed up in her office late one night with a request for tide tables for a target in the Pacific so secret that only Sears could be trusted to make the calculations. Staving off exhaustion, Sears pulled tide tables for the nearest locations and extrapolated new ones for the secret locations, all on her own. Bleary-eyed, she worked until morning with no one to check her top-secret arithmetic, all the time worrying that she would make an error. No one reported that she ever did. Comprehensive studies of further Pacific targets were fast-tracked in the coming months, and Sears' input proved invaluable. At the Battle of Okinawa, for example, she advised operations planners on their choice of landing beaches. naval commanders favored landing on the western beaches of Higuchi because they offered 9,000 continuous yards of flat sand. But they also knew that these same beaches were susceptible to strong gales. When planning consulted Sears, she performed a last-minute analysis and concluded that the waves at Higuchi would likely be calm. At dawn on April 1, 1945, the largest convoy of Marines and soldiers launched to date in the Pacific sailed toward Okinawa. And as Sears predicted, there was scarcely a ripple in the sea. Less than 3 months later, the Allies had taken Okinawa and were establishing staging areas to prepare possible invasion of the remaining Japanese islands. Sears' timely, exhausted insights, whether excerpted from her team's reports or offered on demand in the middle of the night, helped guide the remainder of the Pacific campaign. While the bathymograph, developed in no small part by her colleagues at Woods Hole, would provide Sears and naval commanders both in the Pacific and Atlantic crucial intel about the depth at which Navy subs would be most perceptible to sonar. The Joint Chiefs issued a new and accelerated priority list for the Janus program. The oceanographic unit became busier than ever, at times working on three comprehensive reports at a time under tight deadlines while simultaneously responding to various urgent requests. The team would eventually issue 20 dense reports covering targets from the Black Sea to the East China Sea. Sears' oceanographic experience helped the war effort in other ways. Ahead of World War II, the U.S. Navy had been concerned about German U-boats, which had been so successful during World War I that they nearly paralyzed British lines of communication, not to mention interrupting supply lines for food and medicine. In response, the Royal Navy had organized convoys to protect merchant ships, narrowly saving the country in the Great War. The U.S. Navy suspected the new generation of U-boats would be more precise and deadlier than ever, and with good cause. U-boat commanders had been refining their tactics, adding night surface attacks to their repertoire, as well as the use of wolf packs, groups of submarines working together to extend a search area and maximize results. The Navy had asked Hydro whether there were worldwide charts that recorded the temperature of ocean water at varying depths at different times of the year. This data would help pinpoint thermoclines, the ocean layers with the greatest temperature differential, where a sudden change in temperature allows the water itself to bend sound waves, distorting sonar. Identifying thermoclines would help U.S. ships determine where enemy subs were most likely to be lurking. Unfortunately, that data didn't exist. But WHOI scientists saw a way for the Navy to gather it. The bathythermograph. The perfection of the bathythermograph as an anti-submarine warfare tool had been a high priority at WHOI for years before the war. Once war broke out, Islin advocated equipping as many ships as possible with the tool, not just naval vessels, but also Coast Guard and merchant ships. Eventually, even submarines were equipped with a modified bathythermograph, which they could use to help locate thermoclines in real time, maximizing the efficiency of their sonar in hiding for the enemy. Throughout the war, Sears collected and centralized bathythermograph data from WHOI and scripts. While several scientists worked with her to analyze the data, it was Sears' job to collect the information, ensure its accuracy, and disseminate it to the submarine fleet. She became proficient at analyzing undersea conditions while compiling publications, such as the Navy's submarine supplements to the sailing directions, which outline hydrographic conditions that would affect submarine operations such as sonar performance and diving maneuvers. Subsurface temperature gradients in the open sea are the chief factors in determining the paths of sound rays, and thus delimit the effectiveness of underwater sound ranging equipment, she wrote. Familiarity with these conditions will therefore aid a submarine to avoid detection by diving to the optimum depth, and it will conversely inform surface vessels concerning ranges and depths at which enemy submarines are likely to be encountered. Sears often included observations from U.S. submarine patrols in submarine supplements. In one instance, she recorded, sound conditions in general were poor. The targets were not heard until the range of 100 yards. The large freighter we tracked was never heard by sound. These were the sort of play-by-play descriptions that submarine commanders were thrilled to receive. Sears reports offered a clearer idea than ever before of what to expect from the oceans. The Navy could not have obtained and centralized this information in any other way. Sears's advisories and the on-demand expertise that she provided at any time of day or night helped the Navy win the Pacific. Even though so much of Sears' work was confidential, she was well regarded in the Navy, and word of her achievements began to trickle out. Please thank Miss Sears for me in regard to the studies put out by her unit, wrote Lieutenant Charles L. Burwell of the Atlantic Fleet to Lieutenant Commander B.E. Dodson, Sears' immediate supervisor. Burwell, a highly respected naval intelligence officer, would go on to brief commanders on weather and surf conditions ahead of the landings at Normandy. Later at Okinawa, he would incorporate many of the oceanographic unit's findings into operational plans. After the war, the oceanographic unit expanded into a permanent oceanographic division, with Sears as the first officer in charge. The Navy would never have to go to war again without crucial oceanographic intelligence. Sears' efforts had made the Navy a more capable fighting force. She retired from active service on June 4, 1946, and still prohibited from American research vessels, headed to Denmark for a year to spend time on the Norwegian research vessel, Gunnar Knudsen. Upon her return to the States, she rejoined Woods Hole in 1947 as a planktonologist and was promoted to senior scientist in 1963. Sears continued her own research, but also took on the role of organizer for the emerging field of modern oceanography. In 1953, Sears became founding co-editor of Deep Sea Research, which came to be recognized as the premier journal of oceanography. We hope you've enjoyed listening to Smithsonian This Week. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Address any comments or questions to us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.